Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. And for those with us live, welcome aboard to our end-of-the-year wrap-up. This is in our ever-popular and world-famous free-for-all melee format, which means even though we walk in thinking we know what we're going to talk about, we're open topic. We're also open phones. This is an occasion where if you're feeling really extroverted and you would like to call in and ask my co-host and I a question, hopefully but not required, about the topic at hand, which is just what we think we saw at 2020, you can call the switchboard. The switchboard line is area code 347-308-8397. And the phone number is also right there on the show page. You can call in if you'd like. If you're feeling a little more restrained, we got the chat room up and running. And you can roll in there with the usual suspects and share your observations during the course of the show. Right now we got Paul and Scott at Parade Rest at the quarterdeck. I'm sure they'll let you in. And you can ask your questions there, too, because we'll be monitoring it during the course of the show. And if we run out of questions, we'll grab one of yours and run with it. And besides that, hey, we're just going to roll into it. Eagle One, good afternoon. Happy almost into 2020.
Hi, Sal. How you doing? How you doing?
How you doing? Just for the listeners, we had a pre-show that ran about 10 minutes. I caution our guests on occasion when we talk about things like, now remember, when the show goes, you have to say it again all over again. But that way we won't seem completely disorganized. And one thing I wanted to kick off today is I looked at what we did over the course of the last year. And, you know, remember this started in a pre-COVID world, and I took out our best of, which even though we count them as episodes, I guess they're not. But looking at, you know, what did we, I'd like to say what we thought was most important this year, though sometimes is who could we get as a guest to come on? But we only ask guests to come on for areas that we find interesting. So, and when I looked at it, I think, that's not too bad. So here's what I saw. We had 7 shows that were general free-for-alls and melees, kind of like we're doing today. A couple of those, we talked a lot about COVID-19 that maybe we'll touch on here later on. We had 4 that focused on national and maritime strategy, 3 on sea lift and merchant marine issues, 2 on the defense industry and shipbuilding industry generally, 2 on budget and policy, 2 on unmanned systems, 2 on China, 1 on Russia, 1 on the Middle East, 1 on the surface force that had a little bit of a media play on that too, because we had Dave Lauder on, but we talked specifically about reporting and issues in the surface force. Also carriers and aviation, space force. We had 1 on strike and missiles. We also did the missile barges with Chris Raleigh, which was great. And we did 1, which I guess was kind of philosophy in leadership, where we had on Corrine Shakes Curran, which people up at the Naval War College will know about her latest book on obedience, which is always a good thing for military people to think about. I think that's a pretty good mix, especially when you consider a lot of the topics that we brought up during our melee. So I don't know if we caught 2020 perfectly, but I think that's pretty solid for 2020 issues.
Yeah, I went back through that list too, and I was impressed by the toot our own horns, but we did a really good. We were really lucky to get some good guests because those topics were all germane to the subject matter of this podcast. And I think people could listen to any one of those shows, including our best ofs, and learn something that they didn't know before about national and maritime strategy and policy, and the things that make it tick, the little stuff that other people don't know much about, but those of us who served know are really important to how we operate our fleet and our national security.
And I appreciate you mentioning about the best ofs, because we have new listeners come along all the time, and not everybody with us has been with us over a decade that we've been doing the show. And I look back on some of the guests that we have that we knew we had good guests at the time, but like, for instance, Captain Hudner, the late Captain Hudner now. We had him on, what was it, like 8 years ago with the guy who helped write his story. And we had the author, Laura, I forget her last name, the author of Unbroken. We had on when her book came out, which eventually became a movie. Thank you, Laura Hildebrand. And it's nice to be able to dig back into the archives and pull those people up as a best of. So maybe some of our new listeners who didn't catch them a few years ago have an opportunity to do that. So those that get the podcast, don't automatically just skip over the best ofs. There's something there you might actually like, or something that we did 5 or 6 years ago that all of a sudden becomes really germane. Because if you remember, we had Tal Manville on over half a decade ago to talk about the birth of the Ford class and some of the concerns they had at the time and some of the that were manifesting themselves, half a decade ago. And when the issues with Ford were breaking above the background noise and in public media, you could tap into that old show with, again, it's just a great quality, knowledgeable guest that informs us today. So, yeah, I like going back to those best of shows. And sometimes our audio quality is a little spotty, but it's the quality of the guest that really matters. And hopefully in 2021 we'll be able to keep that record going. And for the listeners here, I know we're going to try to do that. Not only to have interesting guests, but guests also that, not ripped from the headlines, but are on topics that are germane to the moment.
Yeah, I think one of the things we ought to do as we close out 2020 is thank the people who did appear as guests on this show. I mean, you and I sit around and ask a few questions, and the great guests for us are the ones who take the ball and run with it and share their expertise in a way that makes it comprehensible to even people like me, and that really. And it's interesting to us. I think that's why we continue to do this as we have for the last, Lord knows, 10 plus years, I guess. So I really want to extend a thanks to everybody who's ever appeared on the show, because they've made this as much fun to work on as it is.
Absolutely. And I think on top of that, some of those guests, especially some of our repeat guests, and this is not an exclusive list, and I'm sorry if I missed somebody here, but for instance, Claude Barrabe, Jerry Hendricks, Brian McGrath, Dave Larder, they've also helped us get other guests that we were having trouble getting in touch with, where we can reach out to former guests and say, hey, do you know somebody who knows person X? I've been trying to get in touch with them. And a lot of times, emails are sketchy, or you get in touch with a publisher and I don't know how often they check their send us email contact information, or somebody's on vacation or something like that. And I've always taken that as a good compliment for the format that we've tried to run here with our guests and the regulars, that we create an environment here where people can speak their mind and to flesh out the topics that they have. And also our regulars, I'm looking at Paul and Scott. And I know Chris is there sometimes, Sim, and a few of our regulars who really make the Worthingtons, who really make an effort to call call in on occasion, but usually just come into the chat room and add to the conversation, have really supplied some good questions, not just this year, but in prior years. And it's, we try to put on a good show for those guys, if nothing else, because they do add to the show and help us see a couple of angles that we may not have otherwise considered.
Yeah, I think that's a really important part of this process is getting the feedback and sometimes as you've said before, you know, you look in there and you go, I wouldn't have thought of that question, but that's a great question, and that helps further the dialogue with the guest we have, if we have a guest. And I want to mention Dean Chang too. For to talk about China stuff, I mean, we've talked to Toshihari and. But Dean Chang and you know some of these other people who appear, they're just, you know, they are really nationally known experts in their field, and it's just, you know, astonishing they'll come on the show and talk to us for an hour. I love it.
You know, you look at people who really were on the leading edge and talked a little bit, and you know, we did a couple shows on China, and we've been banging the China drum for a while, and we've had them on multiple times, both together and separately. Is when you look at people in the information space here, you've got to give a tip of the hat to Toshi Yoshihara and James Holm, because I think what really helped bring a lot of people to the realization what was happening with China was their book, Red Star Over the Pacific. That was really the first one that wasn't hyper-academic or you had to read between the lines, where somebody came out and put a marker and was like, people, we need to be paying attention to this. And I think that book came out, I don't know, held a gun to my head, I say 8 years ago. I could be wrong. Maybe less than that, maybe 6 years.
I think they're on their second edition now, actually.
Yeah. And the way things are going, they may have additional editions to come down the road. But I thought they did a really good job. And again, it was kind of like, you know, we had Jerry on recently to discuss his book, and it was a digestible size, because I think one of the worst things you can do when you're trying to get a topic into the general conversation is to plop a 500-page, dense, academic, mumbo-jumbo book in front of somebody or something that's full of arcane doctrine and language and go, here, see what's important. That isn't how it worked, but their book was good for both a knowledgeable, I don't mean that in an exclusionary term, but those who are up to speed with maritime and national security issues, or even those that don't know more than they, you know, read on the front page of the Washington Post twice a week. It was an approachable book, and I think that helped a lot more people get up to speed on the challenge that we're getting from China that now almost everybody has sobered up to. So that's an extended tip of the hat to Toshi and James Holm. They should get more credit than they do.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one other thing that was good, and probably we need to talk about other stuff, but when we had Peter Dean on talking about Australia's peculiar defense situation and how so tied into the U.S. being a major factor in their own defense, it really ought to bring home how important the U.S. is to the world, not just to Australia, not just to Japan, not just to Taiwan, not just to Europe, not just to, I mean, you know, Scott's talking about in the chat room right now, you know, the idea of the world, U.S. is a world hegemon, but, you know, we've been a pretty, what's the right word? You know, we've been a pretty harmless hegemon. We have taken care of this for 75 years. We've been the dominant naval power in the world, and for 75 years we have let the world help the world run more smoothly by making sure the sea lines of communication have stayed open. And I think that show with Australia really brings home about Australia with Peter Dean brought home to me in a lot of ways how important their role is to other countries. I mean, I've known it, you know, when you go serve like at a NATO headquarters or something, you get the feel that people respect the U.S. in a lot of ways. But, you know, the nitty gritty of a country that's totally dependent on the sea lines of communication for its continued survival, you know, that really does drive that point home about how important we have been for 75 years and how important is we not cede any ground or sea to even to an up and coming power like the Chinese or anything to the Russians. You know, we have an international order that works. We don't need to disrupt it if we can possibly avoid it.
And I think good and well-meaning people can argue about a couple of details here and there in the 75 years, but I think you hit right on. We've been a benign hegemon. And if you look at a country like Australia, whose landmass is 75-80% the size of the U.S., continental U.S., but has a population barely larger than the state of Florida, it's scary. You know, we look at the challenge of China that's four times larger population than we are and almost equal in GDP or about to be equal to GDP. You look at these countries like Australia, that's intimidating. And the Chinese know it's intimidating. And you know, they even have nearby neighbors, Indonesia, which has like nine times the population. Not quite as intimidating because they have pretty good relationships with them. But you look at, you know, Japan, Taiwan, that may be one of the, we'll see what the new administration does, but I thought that's one of the underappreciated stories of the last 18 months or so is the increased level of, if not cooperation, understanding of the needs of Taiwan, which is a nation that should be treated as a nation. They are a quite vibrant democracy. If you've seen their fist fights in their parliament, things like that don't happen in totalitarian nations. You occasionally have gunfire in parliament, but not fist fights, and then everybody shows up and does legislation the next week. And you know, Japan is another beacon of light. South Korea. I think of my father's generation who fought in the Korean War as young men. You know, the nation that those people who are now plus or minus a few years from 80 years old, the nation that they fought in when they were young men, when you compare it to the nation of today, South Korea, there's a lot there to appreciate. In the latest defense news, I think Jen Judson was the journalist. She had an article about, speaking of Australia, Australia's upgrading their self-propelled howitzer force, and their primary contractor is South Korean. And the Australians fought in South Korea too. And they're going to be a critical part of Australia's defense capabilities. And that's a pretty amazing story that in one lifetime, you can go from a completely supine, agrarian, poor, backward nation to a nation like South Korea that's not large by any stretch of the imagination, but they're so modern and advanced that they are critical to Australia's defense posture. It's pretty neat.
Yeah, it always reminds me of my dad fought, or at least flew B-26s over Korea. So, and you know, B-17s over Europe. And, you know, we destroyed so much industry, and always the story, we destroyed so much energy industry in Japan and in Europe that they got to start from scratch and end up with more modern plants than we had here in the U.S. You know, that they caught up pretty fast, and in many ways have exceeded us in the ability to produce things like large ships in big shipyards and stuff. So there's a lesson to be learned in that too. We didn't try and keep them down. We didn't keep our foot on their throats. We encouraged them to grow and develop, and You know, that was, I think, the intent. I see that Scott may not be in favor of the Iraqi invasion, but that was at least the intent of what we were trying to do in the Middle East, too, for a lot of the places we ended up rolling through, was that we were going to let them develop into modern nations if they would do so. But, you know, we underestimate sometimes, and I know we've done some shows on this, underestimate the internal mechanisms of a foreign land that we that was carved out of tribal networks that histories go back hundreds of years, thousands of years. And, you know, I once again, you know, what should the Middle East look like, and what will it look like 20 years from now or 30 years from now? That's a topic we ought to talk about next year and get somebody on to, who knows about that to talk to us.
Yeah, I think, like I said, you know, we don't have a perfect record. But part of it, I think, has to do with the fact that we are and remain a very young, a very earnest, a bit too cocksure, and have a little bit of a missionary nature, though I think that's starting to mature a bit after we've stepped on a few rakes recently to see the world as it is. You know, nations who have histories that go back thousands of years or, you know, at least centuries, whether you're talking about, you know, a France or Russia or China, they see the world a little differently because their history informs them that they need to. While our history is still so incredibly brief and bright and shining that sometimes I think we can get a bit carried away. But let's look back at 2020. It's kind of, I was trying to get my head around this about how this impacted the national security environment for us. But the big story of 2020 was and remains COVID-19. And I think for the nation and for the Navy, what really broke above the background noise was the USS Teddy Roosevelt. And that kind of initiated patterns and concerns that the rest of the Navy, not the rest of the Navy, the rest of the nation got hold of, because they were right there at that crux of, is this really going to be a pandemic? What is this? You know, because they did the port visit in Vietnam, and then everything kind of took off from there. What do you think the big impact on COVID has been for our Navy so far?
Well, I think this is one of those cases when if you've ever studied and I did this as part of a program I took in emergency management. But, you know, when you start studying pandemic kind of whatever there's a whole school of education on how do you deal with a pandemic? How do you, you know, the first thing is, you know, we didn't know what you were dealing with. And I think we overreacted at first. I think that they, you know, how many sailors actually died on that ship? And I think it was one, right? Didn't we lose one sailor after COVID-19?
Just one on
the Roosevelt. And, you know, is it because they acted fast and got everybody separated, or is it just that he had some peculiar aspect, you know, some underlying condition we don't now know, or maybe didn't know at the time about? And, you know, the question always is, you know, are we panicking unnecessarily? Not panicking. Are we reacting too strongly, given what we do know, or is it just so unknown that we're going to, you know, freak out every time something like this happens? Because if this, my concern has been that we will. This is going to be a jumble of thoughts here. Here they all go. What happens if you're a bad guy? This reminds me of mind warfare. If you're a bad guy, how do you stop the U.S. in its tracks? You know, if you're using mines, you don't even have to have a mine. You just tell people you mine some water, and then they have to worry whether or not you really did it, right? What if you are a bad guy and you're not really clear on whether or not you want to how do you sow panic? Well, you just apparently announced that you've got some kind of bioweapon that there is no cure for, and you wish it on people. And if you haven't signed some kind of bioweapon warfare agreement, which is, how much is that paper worth? What are you going to make us go through this routine all the time? That would, every 3 years, every 2 years, and when I look at the trillions of dollars we spent on this, I'm going, this is harmful to our national security. Is that we've taken all this money and put it into things that to keep the economy going, which is fine, except maybe we shouldn't have killed the economy in the first place because we were overreacting to a situation we were unclear about, and. And I'm not sure we're still not overreacting. I can't tell. I mean, I have no idea whether I look at the data on whether the death rate increase over what it would normally be caused by COVID-19 is so dramatic that we should have shut everything down. And I am unclear that delta between what would have happened normally, what the normal rate of death is compared to what has happened as a result of COVID-19 is so extreme that we should have completely pulled the plug on so many activities and done almost irreparable damage to our economy as we have done. And that affects directly our national security.
Yeah, I think the post-mortem on this will be interesting. And one thing that distresses me a bit is, for some reason, there is a non-zero percentage of the American population and its leaders who seem to want a permanent crisis where we have to maintain all of these things even after vaccination. We have to continue to sustain the unsustainable. I know it's just anecdotal, but there are six members of my family and people I'm on a first name basis with who have come down with COVID, and they've all been fine. They were feeling bad. I think the most somebody who was really feeling bad and have a fever was about 3.5 days. And they recover just fine. I know there's people who aren't on a first-name basis but are the spouses of distant acquaintances of mine who had pre-existing conditions, who hospitalized and died. And I think a lot of people have known that. But it's not the existential people dropping dead in the street type of situation. I live in a state that has not completely destroyed itself like California and New York City and some outer areas of New York. But even that being said, we've had institutions and small businesses here that have been around for decades. We had a restaurant that was an institution for 47 years that completely shut down. They couldn't survive. I drive by a Walmart. I drive by a grocery store chain, Dollar General, Publix, whatever. Parking lots are full. People are packed. I drive by strip malls that used to have lots of little small businesses. They're dark. They're empty. So how do you recover from that? People who have maxed out their credit cards, how are they going to fix that? I don't know. I don't know. I don't think we've really seen the results of that. From a national security point of view, I haven't seen or heard anybody talk about what they think this has done to retention, but I do know that in times of crisis, economic crisis, people have predilection to leave the military to do other things is much smaller, because regardless of what happens, you're going to get a paycheck every 2 weeks. And especially if you have a family, you're going to do what you have to do to keep that paycheck going, especially if you don't have any prospects on the outside. But things that used to be positive retention items are no longer exist. We have regular long-time deployments. We have quarantine requirements. We have no shore duty. We have no shore leave. We have no liberty. You don't join the Navy, see the world. You join the Navy and do physical exertion with a mask over your face. What type of long-term impacts are that going to have with how people view their naval service when they have an opportunity to get out and go? I don't know. How has that affected people's training and qualifications? And I don't know. I don't think it's been positive. So that's something else. I think once the vaccine, assuming the vaccine is safe and effective, which I have no reason to believe that it's not, once the vaccines get fully into the population, which, you know, who knows when that'll be, maybe June, July, August, maybe we'll have time to start reassessing those questions. But I don't think it's been a net positive anyway. The question is how negative of an impact it has and how many of these bad habits are we going to be able to let go and get back to pre-COVID standards and expectations. That's going to be interesting to see.
Well, I just look at what Congress is doing, and they're just throwing money at people and not necessarily people who are most impacted by what has happened. And if I'm if I'm an epidemiologist and I'm looking at this, and I'm watching it spread, and we've caused it spread to be by isolating people, we've caused it spread to be weird. So we'll get these peaks and valleys. And now that everybody in the Northeast and the Midwest and stuff is spending more time indoors, we're seeing peaks because they're in environments where they don't get out that much. And, you can't get away from people who may be affected. And so we're going to see, is this fall surge or pre-Christmas surge? Is it the final peak, and then this thing's finally going to, with the impact of a vaccine and some kind of herd immunity, is it finally going to start dwindling down? But again, if I'm going to look at my epidemiologists, and I want them to tell me, look, this, we did the right things, we did the wrong things, but overall this wasn't as bad as, and I don't want to use the flu or anything like that. This was not, as you said, the existential threat we potentially thought it was when some guy in Britain posited, incorrectly as it turns out, that gazillion people were going to die as a result of this COVID-19. I'm not sure whether the statistics, and again, the statistics I've been looking at, which are the CDC statistics, and they have a graph in there you can go look at that gives you this, what is the normal expected death rate, month to month, year to year, and they'll break it down by age groups and all kinds of stuff, and how big is the delta between what we would normally expect to see and what we're actually seeing. And that number does not jump off to me thus far. And I could, I haven't looked at it today, but it doesn't look to me like we've suddenly gone, well, I guess we were right to have shut everything down and spent and borrowed trillions more dollars to pass out to people who may or may not have needed the money. But, and I'm not sure, again, like Congress passes these bills, which seem to be designed to bail New York State and city out of their financial problems, as hundreds of thousands of people move out of the city, high income people move out, and apparently lower income people are moving in, and smaller numbers than the people who left. But where are those people going to go? They're going to go to Florida. They're going to go to Texas. They're going to go to Tennessee. They're going to go to states that don't have any state income tax. They're going to decide, well, this is great. I make the same money, but I'm keeping, 30% more of my income because I'm not paying it to my greedy local government. So it'll be interesting to see how this plays out economically. I get worried when we borrow that much money and we're not putting it into national defense. And, you know, we're whining about I hate to say this, we're whining about a $12 billion carrier, which is pocket change compared to the money that goes to fraud, waste, and abuse in other parts of the government. Social Security benefits for people who don't deserve them, you know, Medicare fraud and Medicaid fraud and all that good stuff. It's just that's where I get troubled. We need to do a much better job of policing our spending and controlling where these funds go for all these government programs we've generated. That was my soapbox. No. Hello. Great.
Hello, hello.
Hello? Oh, my. This is great. Hello?
I appear to have lost my line. Am I back?
You're back now.
Sorry to abandon
you. I was in the middle of a long diatribe, and all of a sudden I realized I wasn't talking to anybody.
Like anybody would know the difference. Yeah, it's good to be back. For some reason, my internal line died, so I got to use a direct connect via the switchboard, a little pixie dust and shook a chicken over it, and it appears to be working. So yeah, there we go. Hey, let's see if I can do this without going 990 boo boo. No, I'm going to 990 boo boo. One of my great schadenfreudic joys of 2020, I have to say, and we touched on this a little bit at the beginning of the show, but I want to bring it back because it brings me joy. I think we can call 2020 as the last dance of the China apologists and optimists. There are very few credible people out there that are to quote a former president, quote, welcoming China's peaceful rise, unquote. I guess the question is, okay, now that almost everybody who matters is sobered up, what do you do with it? But I believe it was Scott mentioned that in the chat room that, you know, China is the one country that won in 2020, maybe in the short term, but in the long term, a lot of people and nations have seen, because of the way China has acted with her imperious attitude, a lot of people have seen China for what she actually is. So in the short term, tactically, maybe, but operationally, strategically, I think there's an opening here to pull the scales from people's eyes to see what they're actually facing with China. And I think that succeeded. You there, everyone?
Yeah. Yeah, I can hear you. Yeah, I think you're right. I think that a lot of people are waking up to the threat of China. A lot of people are deeply in debt to China. So this is going to be an interesting next 18 months, I think, are going to be really interesting to see what the reaction to COVID-19 is and whether Chinese are going to stop this aggressive foreign relations thing they've suddenly jumped on. What do they call it? Tiger or something or other.
Wolf warrior or something like that, maybe?
Yeah. Wolf, tiger.
Typology, tiger blood, wolf.
I was a Cub Scout leader. Say wolf, tiger. No, it's tiger, wolf.
But I think you made a good point there on the economic side. I think they are winning because they have a lot of economic might, whether it's dangling the debt they own over their head or the fact they're using graft and bribery and corruption in parts of the world that it works. I think they made a mistake in they could treat Australia like they treat Burma. That didn't work too well. But and I think diplomatically, maybe it's a wash. But economically, yeah, I think they have the upper hand there compared to us for right now. And militarily, it's approaching parity in the Western Pacific, which is one of the nice things that for those that saw last week. Secretary of the Navy Braithwaite be adopted by the new administration. It's advantage at sea, prevailing with rated all domain naval power. It mentioned in there something that we've talked about with our guests here quite often through the years. And that's the fact that you just can't look at the raw numbers of the two navies combined because China's navy is concentrated in the Western Pacific while we maintain a global presence. And when you look at the local numbers, concentration, and capability, it's much different than it looks like on paper and not in our favor.
Yeah, that's right. Well, you know, I mean, China's a recurring problem. Russia is a recurring problem. I keep thinking that Russia's going to calm down a little bit, but I just can't. Every time I think that's going to happen, then Germany does something which makes me think that Germany and Russia are much more in cahoots than we originally thought, and I am deeply troubled by that relationship and where I see that going. Now, I could be wrong, and I'd love to be wrong, but if I were Germany, I'd be doing everything I could to get out of some of those things or the deals they've got going with Russia, but they don't seem to be headed that direction. Maybe you know more about the Germans than I do.
I think their business community and economic people are very, very attracted to the economic possibilities of Russia. And that's a long-term German issue before there's even a Germany. The attraction to the East, you know, the Hanseatic League, the now pretty much extinct Baltic Germans, that whole structure was based around getting economic ties to that vast resource and trade prospect to the East. And that seduction is very much there. I think the national security side of the concerns are taking a back seat to that. The classic example is the Nord Stream 2. For God's sake, the thing is run by a former lead bomber for the East German Stasi and a corrupted former German chancellor of the FDP. It's almost comical, and yet they keep pursuing it because they can save a few cents on gas per cubic meter than sourcing it from someplace else. Short-term economic sense that lots of pockets, but the long-term strategic danger of having Russia being able to tell Germany, yeah, why don't you go burn some wood this year because you're not going to get your gas. That's not insignificant. And, of course, as usual, the Poles and the Balts are caught in the middle. But I think there are some people in Europe that get it. Sweden announced earlier this month that they're increasing their defense spending. I had to double check this. I didn't think it was correct when I first read it, by 40%. You know, they're only a population of, I think, 9 million. But could you imagine if Germany increased her defense spending by 40%, what that would do for the NATO alliance? You know, Sweden's neutral.
Yeah, but bring Germany back where they should be.
It would. You know, I think your math is spot on, because I think they spend 1.2 GDP, maybe a little under that, 1.1 defense. So if increase it 40%, that would bring them to what, 1.78? So yeah, they really need to increase it by 45 to 50% to reach 2%. But I'd love for the Dutch to do that as well, because at the end of the Cold War, the Dutch had 1,000 tanks, for goodness sakes. But you know, Europe's not going to do that, unfortunately.
Well, you know, the French are looking at building a new nuke aircraft carrier, replace or join with their current one they have. So, you know, the French and the Italians seem to be taking things more seriously than a lot of these other countries. You know, they're making some good, they're making some good products. They recognize where their threats come from, and you know, if you've been invaded as many times as France has by everybody, from the Italians to the Germans to the, I mean, you name it, somebody's had a whack at them. You know, I think I would be a lot more inclined to support the kind of level of defense spending that they seem to be willing to do. And the kinds of, you know, they make some pretty smart decisions with their stuff. So,
and I think the French have been smart in their, lack of a better phrase, forward defense in the in North Africa, the Sahel, you know, the southern part of their former colonial areas, because of the expansion of the Islamic State affiliates in that region, both from a destabilization standpoint that pushes migration. And as anybody who follows French politics, the stresses of decades of migration from people who refuse to become French is affecting the broader civil society of France. So they're doing what they can to do two things: stop those nations across the Mediterranean from becoming fundamentalist Islamic nations, and trying to tap down that insecurity, because that drives migration. Whether they'll succeed, time will tell, but at least France is making the effort, and the other Europeans are trying to help them. But like I read earlier in the year where, you know, Estonia had a company running around with the French, but you know, Estonia's got a population of what, 1.2 million? That's like the greater Tidewater area military deploying. It's a nice gesture, but that's not like cosmopolitan France that has a population of like 70 million. I could plus or minus a few million from there. I think you're right. France could spend more, but they are spending more than the NATO average. But Germany continues to underperform.
I just don't think Germany's, you know, I know they want to be like everybody else in Europe. Everybody wants to be the central power, and Germany's got enough trouble trying to keep Britain from departing the very unfair European Union that the Brits never should have joined in the first place. And because what's going to happen is that was the way Germany could control, without invading France, they and the lowlands, they could control the rest of Europe. Well, you know, other countries are going to look at the EU and go, well, we like the open borders, but, you know, this isn't kind of working out the way we thought it was going to work. I think that's going to happen. I don't think I'm not sure the EU is going to be, you know, 20 years from now is going to be something that be much more than a distant memory.
I think the UK, I always thought that the UK was a a good governor on German and French ambitions with the EU, and with the UK out of the EU, it's going to be primarily Germany doing exactly what you said. We're going to make the rest of the Europeans bend to our will in a nice way, not leading with panzers, but with bureaucrats this time. And people are going to push back on it. And you're already seeing the Visegrad group, which includes the former ethnicities that became nations of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, plus the Poles, that don't quite vibe with what Germany wants to do. But yeah, it's going to be interesting in how that impacts NATO. It's not going to be quiet once COVID falls to the wayside. Those stressors are going to come back to the above the fold concerns. Just like I have no idea what the incoming administration's priorities are going to be, mostly because they haven't identified their team. But I do know one thing, unlike 4 years ago, and, you know, one thing that we talked about here and other people talked about as well is to realize that they've had the lost opportunity of the Navy. Last 4 years, you know, 4 years ago, people were talking about 355, and that's all we've done is talk about it for 4 years. There's been no real actionable work to build that Navy. And, you know, we're going into the 2020s that have a lot of budgetary stresses that COVID's only made worse. There's no mandate, charter, or discussion point in the incoming administration towards a larger Navy. So we're going to have a widening gap between, I think, three things. The objective, and I think, you know, Jerry Hendricks is real emphatic about this because he's been working this number for over a decade. But the very real maritime capabilities requirements that we have versus our maritime aspirations, what we want to do, some of which is reflected in the document I mentioned earlier in the show. And finally, there's the actual access that we're going to have to the right policy and budgets to be able to build something. And I just don't see with the incoming administration how that gap between those three points is going to narrow at all. I mean, do you see any light there, or is this going to be the big theme that we're going to be talking about in our 2021 wrap up is, oh, holy crap, look at this.
Yeah, I get concerned when a administration, which seems to be first, is a rehash in many ways of the Obama administration, maybe a couple of different players, but you know these folks, if they're not socialists, are on, you know, they are extremely progressive is probably the way to phrase that. And, you know, if they see buying votes is their way to continue in power, you know, we don't normally talk politics, but, you know, so that means that the money that they see coming in will be devoted to social welfare programs and not to a defense. And, you know, maybe there's somebody there who's smart enough to figure out that if we employ people in defense industries and, you know, encourage the development of shipyards and put people to work and, you know, and bring back the steel mills so that we can produce stuff in this country and, you know, do many of the things that the current administration was trying to do, get U.S. companies back in the U.S., or if not in the U.S., at least in U.S. allies like Canada and Mexico, where we can, you know, and not a sworn and rather devious enemy who will steal everything they can, you know, then that is good and will help the U.S. have jobs. And that will be the social welfare program that's really needed rather than continuing to put people on handouts from the government. And, you know, we were there. We were at 3 or 4% unemployment. That is the way I remember it from my economics classes years ago, was that was pretty much full employment by the standards. Yeah, so I have trouble figuring out how we're going to get, having put a lot of small businesses out of business, how we're going to get from where we are to where we should be.
And that was
with
a real shame.
With this incoming administration, sorry.
Yeah, and that was the real shame about COVID's timing, is we had reached that point without turning this into an economics podcast. But you know, one of the stories, and I know you're a couple years older than I am, so you saw this more than I did, but it used to be that you could own a house and raise a family of four on one income without having a graduate degree and two incomes, et cetera, and so working 70 hours a week. And there'd been a decay, and to use a phrase I can't stand, but I'll use it, a working class incomes had continued to degrade relative to the white collar jobs. And when you reach full employment, what you have is you have good pressures on wages, where people, if you want to hire and keep good people, I know because I had this challenge, you have to pay them more. And it doesn't have the inflationary problems that it used to, but it does raise the living standards for those in the middle to lower middle and even lower classes. And that's been lost. So I don't know how you pick up the ball from there, because this does kind of go into the national security environment, because it affects the focus of our government and our people. But when you look at the impact on our nation and its people and the small businesses, as you mentioned earlier, how much they suffered relative to the large corporations and the highest quintile of income earners who have actually done very well since COVID hit. That's not healthy for the internal stability of a country. And if we have knock-on effects, which may not be race-related, but maybe economically related, like we saw this summer, it's very hard to focus on growing global threats on the other side of the planet when you are concerned about blocks of burning houses and businesses in Minneapolis, LA, New York, Atlanta, you know, pick your city. That again is going to be a story of the 2020s, how we get back to that situation we were at right before COVID. Do we can start to have manageable and positive wage increases for those in the lower half of the economic spectrum? Because it's important for internal stability.
Well, we had the lowest levels of unemployment in African Americans and maybe in history, perhaps recently, had lowest employment in Hispanic Americans. You know, we were on a rise, a good rise, and maybe it wouldn't last forever. But you know what happened? It seems to me that a lot of what has happened, and you know, I'm a huge believer in the First Amendment, huge believer in free speech, huge believer in the freedom of the press. What I do not like is what has happened to our press, which is that we are cranking out. There used to be, you had newspapers that covered a wide spectrum of political thoughts, the Wall Street Journal compared to the New York Times. You had, you know, a lot of really good newspapers in Omaha and Minneapolis and Salt Lake City and San Francisco. You had a couple of papers, you know, they had different, and the Oakland Tribune. You had all these papers that had different viewpoints. Well, now the majority of media seems to speak with one voice. And the voice is very anti least, and perhaps with some reason, anti the Trump administration, anti the Bush administration, anti, you can take either Bush administration, put it in there, and that that continual grinding against conservative or at least non-progressive, non-way progressive people is poisoning a lot of our public dialogue. We need to get back to where people could have opinions and people could agree to disagree about those opinions. I mean, that is one of the benefits of a free society, is when everybody gets to say what's on their mind, and you either you go, well, okay, that makes sense, or you say, no, that doesn't make any sense, I'm not going to listen to you. But to be told that you not only can't listen to them, but you're a bad person for listening to them, and you could lose your job for having an impure thought, that's a very dangerous situation that has developed. And I don't know how we're going to, you know, it's going to take some time to get back to the willingness of people to listen to different opinions and accept the idea that it's okay for you and I, for example, to not agree on a given topic, or at least to discuss it, and maybe we can come to some kind of agreement. But just to totally shut somebody off because they don't, you know, they don't see it your way right to begin with, that is a horrible situation, and we've got to find a way to get around that.
Yeah, I think what, you know, something that's always been there on the fringes has gone mainstream, and that is it's not just that I disagree with you, I'm going to destroy you. And it used to be that it might be somebody who is a competitor for you at work or politically or in your love life who would go after you because they disagree with you. But now people who are totally unassociated with you and maybe on the other side of the country find out second or third hand that you have an opinion with, and they will conspire with others openly or unopenly to get you fired, to ruin you, to embarrass you, to endanger your family. We've seen that for both public and private people that's happened. Yeah, I agree. That is a new malignancy. It's almost as if people no longer have the right to be wrong. I still, I try to be friends and associate and talk with people I don't disagree that I disagree with. And I'm like, well, you know, we just have to agree to disagree, or you know, you have the right to be wrong. Fewer people seem to have that, and what's worse is Razeev Khan, who is a geneticist, who said something the other day that he said that people should be a victim of cancel culture or the mob at least once, because that's the way you find out who your friends are and who aren't. The worst is when people, and I think this is why they do it, they see the mob going after somebody and important people, people that have some heft. They don't rise to their defense. They don't tell people that, hey, you're attacking this person because you disagree with them is wrong. And we don't have enough important, influential people doing that. And again, that sounds like a cultural thing, but it goes again to domestic tranquility. If we cannot, as America, what fair-minded people could talk about being arbitrary or even trivial items without wanting to destroy society, you're not going to have domestic tranquility there. It's just you're going to, I think you use a great phrase, wear down. It's going to be like a rasp. Every time that happens, it rasps away another layer of civil society, and you just wear it down and wear it down and wear it down. And eventually people, there's no goodwill left. And people who would shrug will go, no. And that's an ugly place. And I think we've already seen some of that. But that's a hell of a depressing way to wind up our 2020. But you know what?
Oh, yeah.
It's important. It's important.
It is important because we you see people saying, I mean, this is I have, you know, you read this and you go, well, I can't believe that person meant that. But, you know, they're talking about re-education camps for Trump supporters. You know,
yeah.
I mean, I don't know what idiot said that or, you know, what prompted that particular comment. But, you know, the concept that an American would be put into that another one American would suggest that another American be put into a re-education program to, you know, to get their mind right. I mean, that is appalling. And we need to, all of us need to stand up and say, no, you know, they may be wrong, but they have the right. Then, you know, what was the old saying, Voltaire, you know, I may not agree with what you say. Well, defend the death your right to say it. And, you know, that is that is a building block of this country that people had, just as you said, they have the right to be wrong, and we have the obligation to defend their right to be wrong. It's what the American Civil Liberties Union used to stand for before they got all politically correct themselves. You know, if they're going to defend Nazis marching in the largely Jewish community of Skokie, Illinois, then okay, that's, you know, that is what they were for. You can't then say, well, we don't defend Nazis now, you know, because we did in the past doesn't mean we now think that they have the right to say what they said. No, you got to be consistent, and you've got to abide by what the Constitution says. People have the right of freedom of speech, and that right should be very narrowly restricted. And, you know, I remember when I was in law school and we talked about, you know, yelling fire in a crowded theater. Well, that was an exception, and they keep trying to expand that from a particular situation, a crowded theater and somebody causing a panic, to somebody giving giving a political view with which they disagree and saying that that somehow is the equivalent. It is not the equivalent. It is just an opinion. You can agree with it or disagree with it. You can ignore it or pay attention to it, but the choice is yours. But the speaker has the right to say what he or she thinks.
Yeah. And it's been shocking for me. People who make their living based upon the First Amendment are not rabidly defending it simply because they're afraid of being yelled at next. So we need a lot more bravery from high profile people, and we need,
look at the New York Times. You know, Tom Cotton publishes an op-ed, right? An opinion.
Oh, that was horrible.
Yeah. And you know, whether the opinion piece was good or bad, I don't know. I didn't even read the thing. But now the guy who edited it or whatever he did, for the Times has been, you know, he's resigned from the Times because of the pressure brought by his peer group at the Times for having sponsored or whatever Cotton's opinion piece. You know, that is not right. That is just, you know, that is, here's a guy losing his job, resigning, but, you know, effectively being fired by a mob veto. That is exactly wrong. That is, and the New York Times, of all places, which should be given all the junk they publish, should be a bastion of, you know, free speech for thee and me, not just for me.
Yeah, that's the loss of the institutions, and that whole framework is going to have to be rebuilt. I don't know very many people outside of their echo chamber that look at the New York Times as being the newspaper of record. When until recently, and again, I'll try to be partisan here. However, everybody knows I'm right of center, and that's okay. But don't look me in the face and tell me Jen Rubin and David Brooks are right center. They're not. They are center to the left of center. The only place that's ridiculous. Don't tell me you're the newspaper of record. You're not. And they're not. They're not even close to it. And, you know, the Washington Post, that's one of the frustrations that I have with, and, you know, some of the people that we both talked to. They have lived and worked inside a community of Washington, D.C. so long. So much of that, those assumptions are based on the Washington Post. And that's not reality. And there's a reason why most of the richest counties in the nation surround Washington, D.C. And that view has always been disconnected from the rest of the U.S. It's even more so now. I don't know how you fix that either. Maybe everybody being scared out of the cities by COVID and moving into small towns will change it, but I haven't seen that yet. If you have oligarchs, what is it? The Washington Post belongs to Bezos, and the New York Times is underwritten by Vincent. Who's that from Mexico that owns the cell phone monopoly?
Oh, anyway, yeah.
Not important.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, I mean, the problem also is that the college campuses, you know, you can go through the whole litany. You begin to sound like a right-wing nut, but the college campuses are not encouraging free speech. I mean, I remember that when I first went to Chapel Hill, the big deal was, the fight was whether or not we'd let communists speak on campus. Now the big fight is whether or not you'll let a conservative speak on campus. I mean, it is 180 degrees out from where we started. Well, you know, I don't care. Both people should be allowed to speak on campus without, and if people want to go hear them, fine. If people don't want to hear them, fine. But, you know, now if you were to bring, I don't even know a good example of a conservative, Ben Shapiro, to a college campus, you know, he's going to get, they're going to be a threat of riots. They're going to be, you know, but you could bring some well-known communist on board and you know, nothing would happen. The right-wing folks, the conservatives on campus are not going to threaten to cause all kinds of disruptions. I mean, this is a one-way street and it's got to change. And, that's my soapbox for the day.
Well, I agree with you. I always blame the administrators. The administrators are cowards. I keep waiting for some administrator to walk forward and answer a student and go, this is college. We're here to create an intellectual unsafe space. If you've come to my liberal arts college and your assumptions haven't been challenged and made you feel insecure, then I have failed in my job. But that's my fantasy world that doesn't exist. I guess it's past our time to go. This is our last live show for the year. So if everybody has hung out with us this long, then that tells me that you are a fan of Midrats. And if you are, if you want to give us a Christmas present, go over to iTunes or any podcast aggregator that you go to. And if you're not already subscribed to the podcast, because I know some of y'all just get them when you want to, but subscribe to the podcast. Please give us a 5-star rating. Don't give us a 4-star because you're modest. Give us a 5-star rating with a couple of nice words. That'll do, whether you think we're full of it or not, but you like us Midrats. When people go out and they search for national security, military, Navy, something like that, a podcast to listen to for the search engine optimization. If we get more 5-star reviews, then we'll pop above the background noise and they'll be able to give us a try. So I'd ask for you to do that. To my illustrious co-host, man, it's been another great year, and Merry Christmas to you and yours. And I hope you don't get rain, because I know where you are when it rains and gets icy. Nobody there knows how to drive in the snow. And the whole place comes apart. So have a great Christmas with no icy black ice or bad roads.
Well, same to you, Sal, and Merry Christmas and best wishes to you and your family. And well, oddly enough, one of the sweet things is this last week was watching the snow hit the Northeast and none of them being able to drive in it either. So I don't feel so bad about not being able to drive in snow and ice down here now.
And also thanks to Scott and Paul and the other folks that popped in and popped back out of the room, and everybody who's been a regular here. Y'all just show great. So just we'll book in it by saying thank you to them too. And if If anybody has some guests they'd like for us to have on, pop us an email, drop us a note. If there's somebody you think would really be a good guest, we'd love to get your ideas. And I guess we'll see everybody in 2021.
Yep. All right. Enjoy everything. Ho, 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 ho.
Ho, ho, ho. And thank you, everybody. We'll see you in the new year and hope everybody has a great Navy Day anyway. Cheers.
Friend and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same. It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go. It's a long way to Tipperary, to the sweetest girl I know. Goodbye, Piccadilly, farewell, Lady.